is the Back Porch Education Podcast. Join us today when Steve and I try to think through prior times in history when education was interrupted. Get your education. Back Porch Education. Good evening, good morning, good afternoon. Steve, I'm a little bit nervous about this episode today because I'm not sure where it's leading. I don't have a strong thesis to, pin at the end, and I don't have a bow to tie on it. But I do think that it's an important conversation. Well, I don't even know that I think it's important. It seems like it might be a good idea, a worthwhile idea, to consider the decisions that previous teachers, previous parents have faced when, for one reason or another, natural disaster or what have you, education is seriously knocked off the rails. What do you think?
Well, I'm looking forward to a conversation. I'm coming at it from the perspective of I'm regularly, and I know our listeners will be shocked by this fact, but I'm regularly accused of being philosophical but not practical.
Uh-huh.
And I believe...
That old lie.
That old moniker.
Yes.
I'm a firm believer that having yourself philosophically... attune, mm-hmm. Leads to a good performance or practical things. And I think if we're going to kind of imagine our way back through history and what would teachers have done when you can't do it the normal way.
Yeah.
My opinion is that one's definition of what education is going to determine the success with which you pivot or find yourself sort of wandering in the dark because you're not really sure why you were doing what you were doing to begin with.
Nice. Okay.
So, I'm looking forward to this. I'm going to go ahead and admit to the listeners that we kind of grabbed a timeline of past pandemics,
right.
and don't intend to bore you with historical facts and figures.
No.
How many died and all that kind of stuff, but more just use it as a basis to do a sort of a thought experiment here.
Yeah.
Of given where we are in 2021 and what we've gone through over the last year with the COVID situation.
Yep.
It's not the first time it's happened in history.
Right.
What can we learn?
Yeah. Right.
Is that
exactly? Yeah. That's just it. That's very good. What can we learn? And not learn, like you said, based on some information. But what can reflecting on prior times with the knowledge that we have, what can that do for us? What can we learn sort of out of our own heads, as it were? Right?
Yep.
So, what do you say to an old poem? Nothing at all.
How old is it?
Yeah, good question. I was going to ask you, when I say old poem, what do you think? Early Frost? No.
Beatles? I don't know.
Nice. No, I'm thinking Parmenides.
Okay, Pindar, something like that.
Yeah, nice, okay. Nice. So Parmenides was one of the pre-Socratics. And for those of you who maybe aren't familiar with the pre-Socratics, it's fine. Just means real, real old, right?
Before Socrates.
Exactly.
Not to be condescending.
No, no, of course not. He wrote a poem that some say is the foundation of the Western mind.
Wow, I didn't know he had that.
Yeah, yeah.
Hung around his neck.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Okay.
On nature. Yeah, and so it's divided into three parts: an intro, the way of truth, and the way of opinion. But I'm just gonna, it's very long, and I'm only gonna read about half of the introduction. Although it's excellent. So it's worth a read. But here we go. Listen to this part. Welcome, O youth, that comest to my abode on the car, that is carriage, right? On the car that bears thee, tended by immortal charioteers. It is no ill chance, but right and justice that has sent thee forth to travel on this way. Far indeed does it lie from the beaten track of men. Meet it is that thou shouldst learn all things, as well the unshaken heart of well-rounded truth, as the opinions of mortals, in which is no true belief at all. Yet nonetheless shalt thou learn these things also, how passing right through all things, one should judge the things that seem to be. But do thou restrain thy thought from this way of inquiry, nor let habit by its much experience force thee to cast upon this way a wandering eye, or sounding ear or tongue. But judge by argument the much disputed proof uttered by me. There is only one way left that can be spoken of. And from there he goes on to discuss the way of truth. So he sets up a dialectic here. Two paths, two roads diverge in the yellow wood. We have...
So Frost is a thief.
Yeah, that's right.
Plagiarist.
That's right.
My suspicions.
Unshaken heart of well-rounded truth, that's one way.
Yeah.
And the other is the opinions of mortals, in which there is no true belief at all. But he says they're both, Parmenides says, they're both worth learning. Because if you know the prior, the better, then you can easily judge the things that seem to be. Why did I choose this one in particular? Well, I guess because it's a little bit mysterious. It's very old, but it's grounding in a way that I think is important when we're thinking about a topic like this. So, you want to start in Athens, if that's where we're...
I'd follow up on your poem by saying that it's a way of saying that the more things change, the more they stay the same, right? And that we're building off this notion that there are some things, regardless of time and place, that as they pertain to human education are so, right?
Yes.
That you might look, for instance, they were starting 430 BC in Athens with the first recorded pandemic, right? Which had a pretty fundamental effect on the Athenians. They're in the Peloponnesian Wars. They're against the Spartans. Have their city sieged, and this disease, many think it's probably typhoid, comes up through northern Africa into Europe, and actually manages to get inside the walls. Not going to make too much about social distancing.
Sure.
but manages to take out quite a number of Athenians and weaken the rest.
Yeah.
Probably, if not single-handedly, at least a major factor in the Athenian defeat by the Spartans, who were much less affected by the pandemic. But we're not looking at it from the standpoint of the who won or lost the Peloponnesian Wars, but... Here's Athens, the sort of birthplace of Western education.
Right.
At really one of its high points, its low point, and it's losing to Sparta.
Sure.
But right at the point of founding our civilization.
Yeah.
And it has a gap in its educational process.
Right.
Not nearly as affected because of the differences... Right, that for the most part, education was not for everybody. It was for some.
Right,
and it was mostly a product of the home, whether that was bringing tutors into the home or the parents themselves.
Right,
teaching the kids.
Yeah.
in essence, what we've wound up doing recently is sure. stay-at-home learning.
Yep.
Was the mark of the Athenian. I mean, certainly you're going to have Plato and Aristotle and others found academies
right.
where young men would come to study.
Yeah.
But the bulk, this is back when homeschooling was the majority.
Yeah.
And what we call schooling groups
yeah.
in another
place, co-ops, as it were.
were the unusual.
Yeah.
So we've, by flopping that, we've found that bringing a bunch of kids together for schooling poses mm-hmm. certain difficulties when the sickness comes.
Right.
Or other.
Yeah.
I don't know that we're just talking about pandemics and sure. illnesses. I think the London Fire and some other things come up that highly affect.
Sure.
For a while.
Sure.
How the norm.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the London is an interesting case that we can certainly bring our knowledge of the education of Shakespeare to bear on that conversation. But I want to camp out in Athens for a minute. I remember reading in Maru
that is... Not to drop any names or anything
Not there, to but... drop any names. A History of Education in Antiquity.
Which is an opportunity for me to pitch the Side Porch product.
Oh, absolutely.
My survey of ancient, medieval, and modern education, which the ancient part was almost... Probably 80% of it came yep. out of Maru's work.
Yeah, I would say don't... Well, I mean, it would be a bad... it would be bad form for me to encourage someone not to read the book. But I would say that...
provision
it's
yourself.
It's a lot to dive into unequipped, right? And so if you can't, sort of getting a lay of the land before you plunge into all of the idiosyncrasies of antiquity, I mean, this thing is a weighty book. So anyway, I remember him saying in here that around the time of the Peloponnesian War is when, I'm not going to be able to find it now, but education shifted in Athens from being a military education to a civil education.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Still fitting that notion of wisdom and virtue.
Oh, absolutely.
I would say that one starts to, it almost flipped. I think virtue,
mm-hmm.
in particular the courage of the warrior,
yeah.
when you're reading Homer or whatnot, is the thing, the arete, right?
Yes,
the live forever because you were brave enough to win the war, so to mm-hmm. speak. And now they see that, especially as they move in the democratic direction,
right.
that a good citizen, a wise,
yeah.
certainly still virtuous, but now wise,
right.
and their education. I think one of the reasons they could survive and thrive even after 2/3 of their population gets decimated by a pandemic
mm-hmm.
is because it was simple.
There
was not a
society was simple?
No, the education itself. Uh-huh. I mean, I've gotten myself into some wonderful arguments, but I still think it's true that you can boil the curriculum of our founding educational system down to two subjects, poetry and P.E.
Uh-huh.
And yeah. And Maru doesn't find much more than that. Now, by right. poetry, we don't just mean what we do at the start of every podcast.
Right.
It's the whole, how that fits in with music.
Well, sure.
Composition.
Right.
But the poetic.
Yeah.
The knowledge of the word.
Right.
As... defines me, mm-hmm. not as something out there that I take tests on.
Exactly.
But that becomes me.
Right.
And the body, the mind and body are brought together through poetry and physical discipline.
Yeah.
Right. By physical education.
Skill.
PE,
Yeah.
They mean the Olympic Games, and they mean the wrestling, right, and they mean all the stuff that Paul's talking about. I condition my body daily that I might run the race well. Yes,
right.
And he even ties it into the spiritual life of so my eternal soul has to surely keep up with the body.
Right.
Right. And I think that puts a, when I talk to homeschoolers today, right, one of the concerns is I've got to teach all these different subjects. And I try to find a way to without saying, no, you don't.
Yeah.
Say, yes, but I don't think it's as complex as you're making it.
Yeah. I love the notion that you've introduced of simplicity and complexity, which I introduce as often as I can, because I think it's a super helpful discrimination to make. And I always, anytime I start using the words simple and complex, I always hasten to add that those are not correlated with easy and difficult.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That something can be very simple and extremely difficult.
Maybe because of it. So
exactly. Jump over that bar.
Yeah.
Right. That there's no ambiguity. Right. There's no there's no two ways about it. But the high jump is enormously difficult.
Right.
Right. So I think that's right. And perhaps that's one of the things that as a teacher in Athens, perhaps that would be a guiding principle that we would be thinking about if we were in that situation of, well, it's the cultivation of wisdom and virtue. Right. So whatever that means for these kids right now, that's what we're doing.
Right, right. And not, well, I think this will come up in other places, but one of the thoughts I had in my head as I thought about this was part of what we do to ourselves is come up with a notion of what school ought to be, and then just about kill ourselves trying to flesh that out even when the circumstances change.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
And so when something unexpected comes along that makes us have to pivot, we struggle more with, I would say, the appearances. Oh, we still got to give tests.
Yeah.
Or we got to maintain, we can't let any of the subjects drop.
Right.
I've fought this with school scheduling.
Okay.
Because I have introduced the concept from time to time, and it makes it much more complex.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, to me, it would simplify the problems of education. So if I'm not going to even get into the block scheduling that efficiency experts have introduced into public schooling.
But, sure.
And I know some private schools that do that as well. But for those of us that are still kind of maintaining, we have a number of different subjects we want to teach, and each subject's going to get taught every day, I've questioned why.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't there some subjects that you need every day because of their
because of the way that the mind, nature, yeah, the impression is taken.
The dominoes right? need to keep falling
right.
daily, right? And I would put something like mathematics or a language acquisition or something sure. like that. And those, but that some of the other subjects, we get into this equity notion.
Yes.
That it's about time when some things are taught.
Yep.
Led into with more easily
mm-hmm.
than other subjects, and therefore don't need the same amount of time.
Right.
In fact, some of the subjects suffer from not having enough time.
Right.
And the teachers always like fighting bell to bell.
Yep.
And if they were given some sort of a schedule that allowed them a little more time because some other subjects that don't need it.
Yep.
And I'm not going to get into the war of what subjects do and don't so sure. much as the fact that I don't. In this conversation, I think it's enough to just simply say that we sometimes build barriers for ourselves in our mind that are not necessary
yeah.
for real education to occur.
Right. The structure, the tail is wagging the dog.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like the structure is, I don't know. Yeah, it's, we see this sort of thing all the time, right? When we have a group of people who kind of forget what they're doing and are just constantly talking about how they're doing that thing. And there are conversations to be had about how we're doing education. We should have those conversations. We should continue to do that. But in the end, again, let us not be accused of being philosophical instead of practical. What we're saying is how we get there depends on where there is.
Yeah.
So bringing up where there is eminently practical.
Right, right, right. Yep. Well, I wanted to mention the Justinian plague because it's an interesting...
Yeah, dude, I don't know much about, like, basically anything about this, so lay it on me.
Well, the emperor, Justinian...
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Is made emperor of Rome...
Right.
...at a time when Rome is busting up. We're talking 541 AD.
Oh, boy.
All right?
Okay.
So the empire is crumbling...
Right.
...in part because of some bad choices they've made in education... That virtue thing wasn't going real well for them. But so Justinian has these great plans. He's a great general. He looks like he's going to successfully be bringing the empire back together.
Okay.
He maybe is a little foolish financially. But
currency debasement, all this, is that inflation spending, and all that? Oh, yeah, spending. Okay.
Trying to recover the glory of Rome through the pocketbook.
Right. How about another Colosseum? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And right in the middle of it, right smack dab in the middle of it, is a plague.
Huh.
Most of the Mediterranean world was affected by it. It affected... things not, and this is why I wanted to bring it out. It wasn't just the fact that people were dying. It's the mental, spiritual effect that it had on people.
Okay.
Christians, for instance, who at that point are very important to the Roman Empire.
Yes.
Right, this is after Constantine.
Right.
View this apocalyptically.
Mm-hmm.
This is the end of the world. This is what Jesus was talking about. And it wasn't. Apparently, that was wrong.
Right.
They had to deal with this for almost 20 years.
Mm.
I mean, this is way before we understood what a plague, what...
Yeah, germ theory.
Bacteria. Yeah,
right.
It's completely foreign.
Right.
In fact, notably... part of what made it last longer is people fleeing Rome.
Yeah.
Everybody's dying. Let's get out in the country and taking it with them.
Yeah, sure.
And
sure.
Spreading it.
You're right.
So they estimate 50 million.
Oh, man.
26% of the world population at this point.
Wow.
1 in 4.
Wow.
That has to have rocked. Now there's a lot more there, too. So again, context. Education is struggling in the Justinian Roman world, right? The old ways have been thrown aside, and there's been a lot of what we were just talking about, going through the motions, a lot more stuff of a practical nature, and school for schooling's sake. So when you've got this level of illness raging through your circumstances, right?
Yeah.
I don't know enough about it to know if it completely ceased.
Right.
But many will point to the Justinian plague as a major player in the eventual fall of Rome. And I would say probably as much for how it disrupted the passing on of the culture.
Exactly. Tradition, right?
Yep.
As the hand to hand.
As just death toll. I mean, 1 in 4 is a big death. That's going to affect things. But of those surviving, there's just like this great blank.
Yep.
You know, we're starting to talk about gaps.
Yeah.
Here's a gap.
Well, right. And when it's a 20-year situation, I mean, this is not... this is not
couple of
everybody missed fourth grade.
Right. No, this is...
Like, this is... Yeah, I mean, kids who would, because at this point still nobility is the major purchaser, right, of education. And so
from about 5 to 14, 15.
Yeah, right.
In age.
Right, right. Right.
Little shorter than ours.
Yeah.
But still, that's start to finish 2 cycles.
Exactly. Right. And so you have men and women whose parents were no doubt educated.
Right.
They're now having children, and they, like, are their kids going to go to school or not? Right? Mm-hmm. Like, but they really didn't.
Can we find a tutor or
right,
not?
Yeah, exactly.
Are we even going to be able to make this work?
Right.
Or should we just forget about it?
Yeah.
Which is interesting because not long after, groups that were never been educated, the quote-unquote barbarians,
mm-hmm.
are running rampant.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it's an interesting drop-off.
Yeah, no doubt. So if you're a parent in Rome, or shortly thereafter, a parent outside of Rome, right?
Mm-hmm.
You retire to the countryside, and now all of a sudden, you are away from community. You're away from the tutors whom you knew. Unless you brought them with you, what? I don't know. I'm struck by one of the things that I keep thinking about with these older plagues,
mm-hmm.
is that it's also something that I'm thinking about. It's probably because I'm reading so much Little House on the Prairie with my daughters, right? But what I'm always struck by there is that when that it's understandable that Laura and Almanzo will sometimes keep Rose home from school. And that it's not because of some outbreak, right? It's just because there is employment for the child in the home.
Right, needed.
Yeah, so school, she's going to school, and, you know, in these various ancient times, people are going to schools, but that is always seen as an opportunity. It's never expected, or it's never the sort of thing that becomes a given to the point that we don't know how to employ the child at home.
Right. Or how to bring them to adulthood apart from this right. act of schooling.
Right.
The vast majority of any society, right up probably till industrialization hits Europe,
mm-hmm.
the majority were unschooled.
Right.
There was a few, typically the ruling few,
right.
that had gained the wisdom and virtue to rise to the top.
Right.
And you know, the term here properly used is privilege.
Yeah,
that's a loaded word these days.
Sure, sure.
But they were allowed something not everyone had a chance at.
Right.
It strikes me as you're talking that we have to. This is pre-book. So you know, 541. We're talking scrolls at best, but most of it oral, which is an interesting thought because. There's a sense in which that's so much more mobile.
Yeah.
It's more tenuous.
Right.
But if you have access to somebody else who has the knowledge, it's transferred orally much quicker. I don't think as well
mm-hmm.
as we've enjoyed since the advent of books. But I do think that there's a factor there that anything we're looking at pandemic-wise prior to books...
Yeah.
Education is of its nature a different animal. It is much more of a of a discussion, a conversation, than assigned readings with discussion afterwards.
Well, the world was so much more separate then, right? Like, the book, okay, fine. The internet brought the world together in a way that hadn't been done before, to an extent that hadn't been done before. But it had been done before, and it was the book, right? Yeah. Well, now I'm thinking about the story you've told before about Wendell Berry saying that education needs to get real local, right?
Yeah.
That it seems to me that education was quite local. And so when you, I'm trying to tie that into the notion, like the orality of it that you were mentioning earlier. You know, you live in a town or you live in the countryside and you're taught there and you live there.
Right.
And what's going on in other parts of the world, yeah, scrolls were really nice, but it wasn't newspaper kind of stuff, right?
Right.
It was stores of wisdom.
Yeah.
So
most of which was poetry and prose.
Yeah.
Literature that could be communicated at least generally by a father to his son. Let me tell you the story of Beowulf.
Right.
Type deal.
Right.
Which is a good one to bring up because it was oral for quite some time. To not get bogged down, I wanted to mention the Black Death, 1350.
Okay. Chaucer writes his Canterbury Tales in the middle of this.
In the middle of it, right? That's an aspect of any number of past downer moments in history that great literature comes out.
It does. It's a very, I can't remember where, but somewhere I heard a teacher say, I think it was Donald Kagan from the Yale courses. He said, maybe it wasn't, that a very Greek notion is, or the way that the Greeks dealt with the world was when they acknowledged, they saw the misery of life and they sat down and painted it as it was.
Mm.
Like that was their response to it, right? Not to run or escape, but to acknowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Chaucer is doing that in a certain sense when he is making good literature, right? He's making something to be enjoyed.
And these are stakes down in the mud of history, right? These are moments of pivot. 1350, a third of the world dies.
Gah.
A third of the world's population at that time. A war is... England and France bring their war to a halt.
Right.
Because they're losing people. They're losing more people from sickness than from the battle. And in particular, what I would point out, and I talk to my students about this on a regular basis because I teach medieval literature, this is where the feudal system crumbles.
Yes.
Because of...
Oh, dude, good point. I hadn't thought
illness
of that.
Just changes. So when we come to a circumstance where things are just radically brought to a halt, they often don't start back up the same way. There isn't, you know, you keep hearing this new norm thing. In a world that's struggling to have norms.
Yeah.
but certainly the medieval world didn't have a problem with norms.
Right.
It's just that when they got going again, it was in a whole different direction.
The infrastructure could not be supported by that amount of people, right?
Right.
It took more hands
yep.
than they had.
Yeah.
And yeah, dude, there was, that's interesting. I'm also thinking, because there was like a series of peasant revolts at that time too, right? Where you have farmers saying, forget this, start paying us better. Like, we're not going to continue to work for these wages because you're living off of us.
Right, yeah. When the pandemic comes, We suffer way more than you do.
Right.
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 Some of you haven't lost a meal.
Yeah.
The rest of us haven't had a meal in a while.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Which carries us on down 1665. Fascinating to me, back on what you said about Chaucer. So you have two pretty significant English writers, one of which writes survivalist literature, having survived the Great Plague of London, 1665, which included in its occurrence the Great Fire of London.
Yes.
Where 90% of the structures in London burned to the ground.
Ooh.
And the plague itself, right?
Yeah.
I pulled up a mortality chart, and it just shoots off the roof. I mean, it's amazing. Between 1665 and 1666, the bubonic plague takes out 20% of the population.
Mm.
And it's so on top of illness, you have deprivation, right, of a fire. And here, Daniel Defoe survives both of these and writes Robinson Crusoe.
The first novel.
Right.
I was taught in my graduate studies. Right. Many view this as the first novel.
And writes this brilliant piece about a man surviving cataclysmic misfortune.
Right.
Right. Being marooned on an island, ostensibly by himself, until the Great Footprint appears.
Mm-hmm.
And 7 years later, in response to Robinson Crusoe, is Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels.
Right.
Swift as well, surviving these two great instances, one of illness and one of fire.
Mm-hmm.
And it is interesting when you compare, these are the last two works we read, my sophomore English class, you have the optimism of Robinson Crusoe that you, in fact, can flourish.
Yeah.
And then Gulliver aimlessly getting marooned in various places that are much worse than places he's been before. And at least the critical literature I read, Gulliver is seen as a purposeful response to Crusoe.
I didn't make it. The class on the beginning of the novel that I took was a summer class.
Hmm.
And that book was one of the last ones, right? Swift. And I was burned out. So I loved Robinson Crusoe. But man, I'm not half as familiar with Swift because I got tired.
Yeah.
It was a summer.
My students could relate.
Right. Oh, yeah. But okay, so then education at that time. Yeah, exactly.
And in the 17th century, you have much more of a sort of typical school books.
Right.
Desk, teacher orientation, lecture.
Right.
Subjects, grades. But still for the privileged.
Yeah.
Still for just a few.
Right.
More
mm-hmm.
than before. The falling down of the feudal system has meant more seek education.
Right.
Because there's more opportunity through it.
Right.
But it's still pre-industrialization.
Mm-hmm.
And pre-compulsory education.
Yes, exactly.
I don't know if we want to get into Horace Mann and his abolishing prisons by proliferating schools, mm-hmm. but it does change things radically.
Yeah.
When, as I think you were pointing out earlier, if you can get an education, it's really helpful to you. This pandemic's making it harder, but you can still survive.
Mm-hmm.
Versus every child, I'm just going to use America here, must go to school between the ages of 5 and 16, must be accounted for. In fact, in part, we've built a whole, in many ways, a whole system that allows for mom and dad to work because there's a place for children to be.
Right.
We've built a workplace that expects a certain level of education or you're not even considered for employment.
Right.
Right. So my grandfather, with a sixth grade education, would have been out of luck had he been born a generation later.
Right.
Both of his daughters headed off and completed college, which were the first two people on either side of their family to ever consider it. Not just women, but anyone.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that changes things. You know, as interesting as it is to go back and look, we have to recognize that context is a lot. You had mentioned before we started recording that the 1918 Spanish flu is really probably what I find myself going back to the most and trying to get some sense.
Right.
And it's 100 years ago.
Right.
So still, medically speaking, distant from us.
Sure.
As to what we can and can't do. But I think the effect is similar. And of course, the death toll was monumentally larger, a lot larger than what we're currently.
Yeah.
50 million deaths.
Hmm.
50 million deaths from the Spanish flu. More, if I'm not mistaken, more than were killed in the war just ending.
Mm-hmm.
World War I.
Mm-hmm.
Not as violent, but I...
Yeah.
I've had the flu. I haven't had the Spanish flu, but I've had the flu. I don't want to...
Right.
I don't want to die from that.
No, definitely
not. That's not a happy thing.
I'm cogitating on how the book sort of allows the... I don't know all the details of Abraham Lincoln's life and education, okay? But we know kind of the folklore of it, right? Stays up late at night, has a few books, and studies them, and is able to educate himself well enough to continue on, right? With little outside help, right?
Yep.
Right. So I'm struck by how we have that... that the book enables, there's this window where the book enables a man or boy like Abraham Lincoln to progress the way he did. And then it's only, I would point to Frederick Douglass too, that he's he's in much the same category.
Booker T.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Sorry, Booker T. Washington.
Right. Right. Douglass steals a book of Cicero's speeches, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, but one of his quotes that I absolutely love is, "All that I know, I've stolen." Right? That he sort of, he gets it from places. He finds it. It's amazing. I wish I was as... hungry for it as he was.
Yeah. Well, in that time, I don't know if it was Twain, somebody voiced the opinion, you know, what if we could throw over the whole formal schooling for a good public library?
Right? Sounds like Twain.
and if I'm not mistaken, it was a comment like that launched the wealthy Dale Carnegie to...
Oh, yeah.
To found these libraries.
Andrew Carnegie.
Andrew, sorry.
Yeah, Dale is
the other dude.
Yeah.
Andrew, to found these islands of mercy.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt.
My little town in the middle of Kansas had a Carnegie library.
No kidding.
And I grew up in that thing.
Wow.
And still judge other libraries somewhat harshly.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was well-funded and had a wonderful... Well, it's just a wonderful library. It was built to be learned in.
Yeah.
And but here's why I brought up industrialization earlier.
Yeah.
Is there's a turn
exactly
in education.
Exactly. So that's what I'm, so the book enables this to happen, but then relatively soon thereafter we get another structural change in society, right? Another a radically different practice of push them all into a place, and we're going to say that's where learning takes place.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really, school started to perform a different function than it had.
Yep.
And I don't know, I think like you say that when, like your comments on feudalism, when things break down, they're often not put together the same way. And I wonder how things are going to look there. I wonder how analogous the internet now is to the book for Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. If it won't sufficiently allow people to return to the home and thereby allow them to have their children at home and have them learning.
Yep.
You know?
Well, and I hear educators excited about the future.
Sure.
And what this COVID break speaks. I hear concern as well. And that's the beauty of considering the future, is you can have both hope and fear. But we're at one of those places. And so I don't think, despite the differences, and I think we've admitted those.
Yep.
I still think there's a great deal of usefulness in running it back through. If nothing else, history teaches us that we can move forward.
Right.
That it isn't, as they thought, you know, in Justinian's time, the end of the world. It might be the end of the world as we know it.
Sure.
But we can still feel fine if we want to. And REM works its way into it. Yes. Do we have to pay for that?
Yeah. Well, like I said, I don't have a bow to tie on this conversation. But the practice of thinking through this is, I think, worthwhile. I'm leaving this conversation with some thoughts that I would like to mull over. And I hope you are, and I hope our listeners are.
Yeah, I have fun.